This is the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. I'm Jeffrey Riley. We have a complicated relationship with food in our country, not just what to eat and how much, but who makes our food and in what conditions. The trend in the food industry has been toward the gigantic, with huge companies dominating. Their size and wealth means they also have great political power. Our next guest, Austin Frerich, wrote a book demonstrating the size and power of some entities in the food business. The book is Barron's, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. Austin Frerich comes from farm country, Iowa, and is an expert on agricultural policy and antitrust policy. His career has included jobs at the U.S. Treasury Department and the Congressional Research Service. He's now a fellow at Yale University. Austin Frerich, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me on.
I wonder how long ago this book began to take shape in your head. I mean, did you know these stories of food barons while you were growing up in Iowa?
Oh, God, no, not at all. I mean, I've been mulling this book for 5 years, but, like, Cargill's my grain baron in my book, and I grew up around Cargill, and I just never appreciated their power until I really dived into this book.
Well, when you talk about the power and what the result is, I mean, even on the landscape itself, you start the book with the story of the Driftless region of Iowa, which you remember is very green and not so much anymore. Why?
Well, part of it is I just spend a lot of time up there. Part of my family's from there. My parents keep a camper up there. It's a gorgeous part of the state. It's very much like the Vermont of the Midwest. And I just seen in my lifetime how much that part has changed. I mean, it was... You see animals on land, and now you don't. You can smell them, but you don't see them. And you just kind of see, the landscape has changed too, where what used to be pastures are now just corn and soy. And the landscape just feels dead. I mean, it feels very industrial. I mean, to me, it's almost like driving the Jersey Turnpike at this point.
Huh. Well, and that really is one of the major points in the book, is that we have this industrial food system. You're certainly not the first person to say that, but you give it in very vivid terms.
Yeah, well, that's kind of my goal of my book, is to show. I mean, I intentionally use this robber-baron framework to show not only have we been here before, we know what to do. Because there's something morally wrong. Like, my book opens with a hog baron, the most politically powerful person in Iowa. He does 5 million hogs a year. There's something morally wrong when you hear that this hog baron has his own private jet. Like, it's almost cartoonish, you know what I mean? Like, that just sounds morally wrong, that he has that much power.
Well, so we're used to concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a few corporations in many industries. Do you see any more concentration in the food business?
Oh, yeah. I feel pretty confidently arguing the food industry in America is the most concentrated space. Part of it is just kind of reflection of the media industry, where you've seen a lot of the local papers that would report on this stuff have been hollowed out. And also just in the food industry, too, there's a consolidation. I mean, there's an illusion of choice. So consumers see all these different brands of peanut butter at the grocery store, but it's really just one company. And then on top of it, I just think USDA is one of the most corrupt agencies in D.C. I mean, by every metric, they fail. I mean, for every dollar you spend at the store, the farmers get the smallest amount ever recorded in American history. They're failing workers. I mean, we're being gouged at the stores right now. USDA pretty much only helps big corporations at this point. Like, that's kind of like one of my big takeaways from this book.
Okay, so let's get into the details here. Again, we're talking to Austin Frerich, the author of Barron's, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. And let's start with the story of the hog farmers you mentioned. These are Jeff and Deb Hansen. Tell us about the big sheds, the confinements, as they're called.
Yeah, so they're the ones that got this whole book going. It was 5 years ago, I was BSing with someone at a bar in Des Moines, Iowa. And they were telling me there's a very competitive governor's race that year. And I didn't know at the time, but Iowa doesn't have campaign contribution limits. And this local person was telling me how Jeff and Deb had given the largest donation to the governor, $300,000. And not only they have a home in the only gated community in Iowa in the suburbs of Des Moines, but they also have a home in Naples, Florida, and they fly back and forth on their jet. And part of me is like, oh, this is what a powerful symbol of what's happened to Iowa in my lifetime. But also, I was really curious, how did that happen? How did one man come to do 5 million hogs? And so I dove into it, and the key thing were these confinements. Is Jeff and his wife brought that industrial hog production model to Iowa and just really dominated that space and essentially drove that family hog farm into bankruptcy. To now, you know, 10 entities do about 2/3, 70% of all hogs in America.
70%, and further numbers here. You tell us that there are 50% more pigs in Iowa in 30 years, and over that same time, 80% fewer hog farms. So a lot of the small ones driven out of business, right? Consolidation?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what used to be independent family farmers are now low-wage workers for my baron. So, like, my hog baron, you know, has about 7,000 people that work for him. And keep in mind, this isn't like you're watching animals on land. This is you being paid to go inside these metal sheds where most animals live now, and you just haul out the dead bodies. Like, 10% of pigs die inside these. So next to every one of these metal sheds in rural Iowa, you'll see dumpsters full of bloated dead pig bodies. That's what the job is now. Instead of being a farmer, that's what you do for the baron. But the other part I make... The point of that chapter and with each of these barons is the consequences of that power. So in Iowa, the thing about pigs is they defecate 3 times more than a human being. So Iowa has about 25 million hogs. They produce as much manure as 75 million people. So that's the population of California, Texas, and Illinois combined. And the reason why he gives so much money to the governor in Iowa is he needs to capture her and control that regulatory apparatus. Because basically that Department of Natural Resources has been gutted. And so there's like very little oversight to all this manure sloshing around in Iowa. So I talk about how like 60 to 70% of the waterways in Iowa are too polluted now for people to use. And, you know, Iowa has the second highest cancer rate in the country. So there's all these consequences from this massive consolidation of power in the food system.
All right, so you're talking about regulatory capture in Iowa, but you know at some point these same streams that are polluted have to meet federal standards. I mean, is the EPA not exercise any power here or make any threats to Iowa's state agencies?
Well, two things. So an undercurrent in my book is you see a race to the bottom. I mean, Iowa engaged in this race to the bottom in hog production because North Carolina started it first. And North Carolina started it first because a state senator deregulated it. USDA could have stepped in saying, no, we are not going to do this production model, but they failed to do it. There are certain standards, but agriculture has certain carve-outs that they're able to avoid. But like, I mean, even look at Oregon right now, I mean, Tillamook is such a national brand now, but most of that dairy is coming from industrial dairy farms in eastern Oregon, which, you know, when you see that, when you have thousands of cows in such a concentrated space, I mean, that's producing a ton of manure too.
Mm-hmm. There was vocal opposition in Iowa, you tell us in the book, but what happened to that vocal opposition?
Yeah, so there's kind of this notion that, oh, this was the most efficient thing, this was technology, that this just happened. And I really realized in my research is, number one, A, corners were cut, you know, through regulatory capture. But two, you know, there really was a real rebellion, as you said. And part of that is just, I mean, in America, your home is your everything, it's your wealth. And if one of these manure factories goes up next to you, it just destroys your home value and your quality of life. And also you had hog farmers who were doing it right, doing it the traditional way, screaming for help because they weren't competing on a level playing field against this model that didn't include all the costs and its production costs. So you had, you know, you had these gyms full of people in Iowa asking for, you know, something to be done. But what happened was, first, the state government took away local control, so you cannot stop the construction of these confinements at the county level. Only the governor of Iowa can. Keep in mind, for reference, Secretary Vilsack, Biden's current USDA secretary, voted in favor of stripping away local control. Huh. And the big point I make in that chapter is, in 2002, this is really like the pinnacle of this rural rebellion, where one of the big issues in that race were these confinements, opposition to them. And Secretary Vilsack was running for re-election as governor at the time, and his opponent, I kid you not, was the head lobbyist for my hog baron. So you had tons of ads on this, Vilsack promising to do something. After Secretary Vilsack won, he oversaw the largest expansion of confinement in Iowa history. So not only does his word not mean anything, he did the completely 180 what he promised to. So that just kind of destroys democracy, destroys people's hope in government. And it really neutered that rebellion. People are just kind of, they fought power and they lost. And I don't think that's been appreciated in certain parts of this country. Of more and more, you see rural America look like extraction colonies, and we shouldn't be surprised that strong men are filling that void, that anger void.
Austin Frerich is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Barron's, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. Let's switch to another chapter and another topic, and it's about the Cargill-McMillan Company. And who knew? This is the largest private company in the country. What does it do?
Yeah, isn't that wild? I mean, they're bigger than the Koch brothers.
Wow. They
move grain. They're all about moving and processing grain throughout the food supply chain. I mean, when I originally put this book together, I didn't even have them in the proposal. I just kind of stumbled on them and realized, oh, wait, there's this massive thing. And I compare Cargill to the closest modern-day example we have, the Standard Oil. They're all about owning the middle. You don't know who they are usually because they're not consumer-facing. They don't have brands that you know, but they help move stuff in between. They process like one-third to one-fourth of the world's grain supply chain. I mean, like, they're still in Russia to this day, and that's because you don't know who they are, and they just want to move that grain. And I use their story to tell this bigger story of what I call the corporate capture of the Farm Bill, how now the Farm Bill is designed to overproduce grains at the expense of everything else to their benefit at our collective expense.
Yeah, that is a key point in the book, and this is what brings us back to the point you made earlier about you think the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, is corrupt and captured, and in this part of the book, it certainly sounds like the farm bills have been written with Cargill in mind and have been.
Yep, and so what's so fascinating about that family history is how much it parallels the farm bill and how much they shape the farm bill. So keep in mind, the farm bill comes out of the Dust Bowl. It was in response to that, where these commodity markets were oversupplied, they were glutted, but people were engaging in very destructive agricultural practices for the environment because they were trying to, you know, to save their land. So they were maintaining that oversupply. So the Farm Bill comes along, and I kind of think of it as Goldilocks, where you'll get a little subsidies, but you had to engage in conservation practices, and that usually meant taking land out of production. Because it was an attempt to find that sweet spot of producing not too much, but not too little. And they were also limited. You could only get so much and all that kind of stuff. But Cargill hated it. I mean, they commissioned their own family history, told over 3 volumes, 1,500 pages. And I used that kind of overlap it with the Farm Bill, where they hated it. They hated FDR because what that system does, the original Farm Bill, is it limits grain production. And they want to overproduce grain as much as possible because that's, in the day, what they are. So they never liked it from day one and attacked it over the years. And I really focus on the 1996 Farm Bill, where it really goes off the rails. I call the 1996 Farm Bill the Wall Street Farm Bill, where now all those interlocking things, like the getting subsidies, but you have union conservation, that's all gone. And also a lot of the caps are gone. So like crop insurance to me is a really good example of it, where there is no cap on crop insurance. And when most people hear crop insurance, they think, oh, rainy day fund. No, it's really just insurance for low prices, where 60% of the premium is paid for by taxpayers. And keep in mind, Bill Gates is one of the largest owners of farmland in America. So he can get as much crop insurance, you know, aka a subsidy for low prices or like a backstop, as much as he wants. I mean, that is what this, what this does is when you're picking favorites, like the Farm Bill now prefers corn and soy, is you're pushing everything else off. So like the person who grows carrots is not going to get any subsidies, but if you grow corn, you get a ton of subsidies. And the last half of that chapter, I really talk about what that means for us.
Well, changed our diets.
Yeah, it really changed our diet. I mean, it takes money to be healthy in America now because of this Farm Bill system.
And so we've got to include the detail here about Cargill basically supporting, enhancing, pushing doubts about organic food.
Yes. Their brilliance and why I think they've been under the radar for so long is they use third parties. They never do things like themselves. They finance other groups who do their bidding. So they finance doubt over organics. They finance people who are very pro corn syrup. You know, I mean, it's just, that's the scary thing is there's so much beneath the surface that we just don't know with them. And they have so much power.
To the point of overproduction, though, we're about a minute away from break here, just by way of warning. Overproduction of grain, then, does that help Cargill simply because the more grain they have, the more grain they sell, period? They don't care what the price is?
Exactly. And it helps them move as much as possible. Because what they've done, too, over the years, as our antitrust laws have collapsed, they made acquisitions through that supply chain. So now, like, they're in beef packing. you know, because it's part of it is Cargill does grain, which gets turned into animal feed, which is, you know, gets turned into these animals. They butcher it, they sell it.
Well, and we mentioned already you're an expert in antitrust policy in addition to agricultural policy, and it's clear that these cross many times in the book. The book is called Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. We're talking to the author, Austin Frerich. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and resume the conversation in about 2 minutes. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley, and we're talking about food. And no, it is not a recipe book or anything like that. It's really about the nuts and bolts of what goes on in getting food from the farm to the market. And in our country, it involves very, very large entities. Austin Frerich, who's an expert in both agricultural and antitrust policy, examines that in a book called Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. Barons as in robber barons. And that's where that all comes back to. And speaking of which, let's move on to another family name here, the Ryman Family and JAB Holding Company, which is, I mean, holy cow, they're in coffee and what else?
Oh, they're even in veterinary clinics right now. So, I mean, this one to me is the most wild chapter. And Eric Schlosser wrote the foreword in my book. He's the author of Fascination. And this is his favorite chapter because it's truly shocking where this is a secret German family. They entered the American coffee markets in 2012 when they bought Pete's Coffee. And within 10 years, they made tons of acquisitions in the coffee space to the point now where they sell more coffee than Starbucks. But you wouldn't know who they are because they have all these different brands. So, like, they own Krispy Kreme, they own Panera, they own Caribou Coffee, Einstein's Bagels, Brugger's Bagels, Buffalo Keurig Cups. And they even bought Oregon's own Stumptown.
Oh, Stumptown. Okay, yeah. When I looked at the list of brands they held, it was like, holy cow, who don't they have other than Starbucks?
I know. It's that illusion of choice, though. I mean, it's really scary because, you think of the workers in that space where you can't bop around, you know, to get higher wages between these places. But more importantly, this is really bad for coffee growers. Could used to be a bunch of different buyers of the coffee and now just one massive secret German family.
Huh. Well, and the family does have, as you point out, some history with the Third Reich. You are careful with your wording in the book, but you certainly do express concerns, as you have already, about corporate consolidation and its compatibility with democracy.
Yeah, I mean, that was a really key point I wanted to make right now in this moment in American history, where monopolists finance fascists. And we've seen that play out in history. And I think lost history was, after World War II, Congress commissioned a report, how did this happen? And one of their big findings was that point. And so we actually did as a country, our military came in and both Japan and Europe and broke up the monopolists that financed the fascists. And I just think given this moment in American politics, I really wanted to make that point. And the family's history is really interesting because they were originally a chemical company in Germany, and the family was very much early supporters of Hitler. You know, they used slave labor. They engaged in all this very awful, destructive practices. And it only came out recently. The British tabloids first reported it, and then the family commissioned, you know, its own history of what happened here. You know, they went public with the findings, made a donation to charity, promised to do better, let's not repeat history. But then I just lost it this last summer where right before, you know, I put the book to bed, the Wall Street Journal reported that the family still sells coffee in Russia.
Oh, well,
and
yeah.
I would argue Putin's the closest thing we have to modern-day fascists. And that to me says your words mean nothing. And it really goes back to my point of, We always want to avoid concentrations of economic power because it corrupts the political system.
Right. And let's, so you when we start looking into in your book the why of why there's been all this consolidation, and it's not just it comes back to one person or one reason, but you do point to Robert Bork, who of course did not get on the U.S. Supreme Court, but his doctrines live on.
Yeah. So, I mean, I tell this history of how we viewed antitrust in America, where a lot of it really goes back a century to Louis Brandeis. He was a Supreme Court justice, and he really had that ingrained notion of we want to avoid concentrations of capital because of the political implications of it. And honestly, companies don't buy another company for pro-competitive reasons. I mean, let's never forget the goal of a corporate executive is monopoly. That's where profits are. And we know that's bad. You know, you have that tension with government where government knows that's bad for innovation, it's bad for farmers, it's bad for workers. And so he essentially helped usher in a regulatory framework where we made it hard for companies to buy each other, and we put in a lot of these competition protections. But Robert Bork comes along and basically dismantles that framework. He comes up with this phrase called the consumer welfare standard that basically said one company can buy another company if you show that prices go down for consumers. Well, I can hire any economist to give me those numbers. And that really ushered in this pro-monopoly framework. That said, to me, one of the biggest hopeful things of this moment is President Biden appointed this young woman, Lina Khan, to be the chairwoman of the Federal Trade Commission. And she came to fame because a few years ago, she wrote a law article about how Amazon's monopoly went viral, and he appointed her. And she's the one kind of leading this return to this old Louis Brandeis framework of anti-monopoly, like kind of reversing that Robert Bork framework. I mean, she's the reason why you've seen the FTC file in conjunction with DOJ, all these antitrust lawsuits against big tech, challenging the Albertsons-Kroger merger, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the Albertsons-Kroger merger because well, we'll get into that in a little bit because of the when we get to discuss the major store chains. But just to get to the basic nub of the Brandeis versus Bork argument, it seems that Brandeis's point was we need the government to be strong to protect individuals, consumers, and Bork's thing is no, corporations will take care of that.
That, and also like to even boil it down more, it's Brandeis is anti-big. I mean, but that's also the hallmark of American democracy is we purposely constructed a political system to deconcentrate power. And people like Bork, the thing to keep in mind with them is they're always a dime a dozen. There's always going to be hacks for rich people. And that's what he is. I mean, to me, what says the most, this might be my New Deal Catholicism showing, but it came out later in the Nixon tapes that he was basically Nixon's hatchet man for that Friday Night Massacre, where he was willing to essentially disregard the Constitution because Nixon promised them a seat on the Supreme Court. The second I heard that, it was like, his scholarship is dead to me. Like, I don't care what this man says at this point. Like, if you don't believe in democracy and you're willing to do it for your own personal gain, throw it out, your scholarship is useless. But, like, I say all this because, to me, I kind of view this as cyclical. It's a natural thing to have these kind of, you know, Gilded Age moments where, you know, you get monopolies form and then we essentially have to have a reform movement to restore competition to these markets. And you're always going to have hacks like Robert Bork come along. And every industry, by the way, has them. That's what I realized writing this book is, you know, there's a hack for my hog baron. There's a hack for my berry baron.
Everybody's got a hack. Okay. Well, I could have called the book Hacks, too, but it's called Barons, yeah. Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. It's the work of Austin Frerich, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Let's get some more examples in here from the book. Dairy farmers Mike and Sue McCloskey, they use something called a checkoff. How have they used it? What is it?
Yeah, so I really want to tell their story because I really want to inform the reader about checkoffs. Because I really think the checkoffs control the conversation of the American food system. So the checkoffs, kind of like most things in the food system, have good intentions but kind of went off the rails in recent years. They go back to the New Deal. It literally was farmers could check a box and pay a little tax to help advertise their good. So like it started in Florida with, you know, drink more Florida orange juice. You know, they just kind of chugged along, weren't that big of a thing. But they really start kicking into gear in the 80s. And that is, as the farm bill was overproducing a few things, the checkoff started. Their goals were, how do we get you to consume more? How do we get you to eat more ice cream? So, like, got milk comes out of the checkoff. So there's, like, 20-some checkoffs now. Most of them don't matter. There's, like, a popcorn. There's a Christmas tree. But milk is massive. It's, like, $700 million a year. And what you see is a lot, and I use this story of my dairy baron to show how he took this money from family dairy farms and used it against them to help drive them into bankruptcy. And USDA failed to do anything and was kind of basically complicit in this. For example, like Secretary Vilsack, between serving as Obama's Secretary of Agriculture and Biden's, served as an industrial dairy lobbyist in between administrations for one of these checkoffs making $1 million a year.
Wow. So let's move on, and I want to talk about Driscoll's, the big berry company, which doesn't grow any berries, as you point out. How does that work?
So it all goes back to chicken, as weird as it sounds. A century ago, when we tackled the meat monopolies in response to Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, we wrote all this regulation, did all this stuff, but we didn't write chicken into the regulations. And that's because there weren't really commercial chicken slaughterhouses. It was, you had a chicken in your backyard, and you butchered it in your kitchen. So what happened was, in the South, business people took that sharecropping model that was really exploitive to black farmers and applied it to chicken production. If you're a chicken farmer in America, you don't own your bird, you're given the feed, you take on a ton of debt, you build these metal sheds to the company's specifications, you give the bird back to them, they weigh in a room you can't see, and it's paid through tournament system. So whoever adds the most gets paid the most, adds the least gets paid the least. I don't like you. I give you the runt. You go broke. You declare bankruptcy. 70% of chicken farmers in America live in poverty. What happened was chicken got a lot of market share from this exploitative model. The USA could have stepped in and said, no, you got to behave like the other meats, but it failed to do so. So they call it chickenization, where you start seeing this replicate across the food system. It replicated in pork. That's how my pork baron probably became a baron, is he saw that and applied it to the hog industry. And I noticed researching Driscoll's, I was like, oh, they're doing the same thing like chicken. So Driscoll's owns the IP of the berry, but they don't actually grow it. They have other people grow it in these exploitive arrangements. So that way the other person can engage in exploitive labor practices and Driscoll's can, you know, plead ignorance.
So help us understand, I mean, are there still a fair number? I mean, these gigantic corporations, it sounds like, do get a lot of their input from farms that are still privately held and on a relatively small scale. But are there many of those left? It sounds like they're all basically working for these big corporations now.
Yeah, I mean, an undercurrent in my book is what is a farmer at this point? You know, a lot of my dairy baron will cosplay as a farmer. He's been on Dirty Jobs, but he claims residency at the Ritz-Carlton, Puerto Rico for likely a tax reason. I would argue the real farmers are the 200-some people that work on his, you know, a lot of these are undocumented men who do the actual farm work. Even in berry production, I mean, you know, given that a lot of it's moved offshore, you know, these are smaller entities that do the farming, but I would almost compare those entities, like, they're a really eerie close example of a plantation. It's like a lot of berry production moved to Baja, California. It's very sparsely populated, so a lot of indigenous workers are brought in. This area is drier, is just as dry as Death Valley, so you know the aquifers are drained, desalination plants were built. It's very, very hard to report in some of these areas. It's very unsafe for journalists. And there's just stories over the years. You know, children, Valley Times did a famous series of how children are working in these fields. I mean, we just don't know. When supply chains get long, transparency collapses. And it's just ripe for abuse.
All right, so let's get to the point we promised a little earlier, which is to talk about where we buy this stuff, and that brings us to Walmart. I mean, I guess I forget sometimes how big it has gotten on the grocery side of things.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Walmart, I like to think Walmart is my king of kings. It's maybe my personal favorite chapter to write, twice as long as any other ones, and that's partly just because I love grocery stores. But, I mean, I didn't think of Walmart as a grocery store when I first started it, but 60% of Walmart's sale comes from grocery. I mean, they sell 1 in 3 groceries in America. That's the same market share as the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th combined. And what's really incredible about that market power is it's with Walmart, it's supply and command, where I think Walmart's the closest example we've ever had in America to a Soviet Union-style Politburo. Because if you're a supplier of Walmart, this isn't a negotiation. Walmart tells you what it wants.
Right. Yeah. And so how do you see countering Walmart's size? I mean, it seems like the other chains just want to get bigger too, as we're seeing in the proposed merger of Kroger and Safeway Albertsons.
Two things. One, and I had a grocery person tell me this phrase, and I love it. Big boys like to run with big boys. And that's the problem is once you have one market monopoly or one robber baron, it creates other robber barons. So like, for example, Driscoll's became a baron in response to Walmart. Those brothers realized early on the rise of Walmart, where one company wanted 4 berries year-round for 4,000 stores. Walmart doesn't want to do a different supplier for each store. So you have that happen. For Walmart, I mean, part of what's going on, so that's kind of what the Kroger-Albertson merger is over, is that's how they're trying to sell it to Congress, is, well, we need to get big to play with another big boy. But the problem really here at core is there's too much big.
All right, so just a couple seconds left, Austin. Do you hold out much hope that the system as we know it will change? It sounds like the dollars, the power, all concentrated in a few hands, and they wield that power quite effectively.
I actually do think that I weirdly think there's a weird bipartisan moment for change. First of all, just the cost. I mean, dollar for dollar, Americans spend more on food at the grocery store than most Western democracies. I mean, when markets are concentrated, they're going to gouge, and that's what they're doing. And, you know, everyone's angry about it. If there's one graph I could include, it would be the beef markets, where literally you see a line of what you paid at the store for beef keeps going up and up every year, but what the cattle rancher gets has been flat. Hmm. And that's just monopoly 101. So I think you've seen anger across the political spectrum to do something here. And then the silver lining I really see, and I think this is huge for the Midwest, is I don't think people appreciate the coming death of ethanol. The Biden administration has been really aggressive at shifting the American car fleet to hybrids and electric vehicles. and that's going to kill ethanol. I mean, most people don't realize the single largest use of corn now in America is ethanol. So what are you going to do with all that, you know, corn land that will no longer be needed? So my big hope is we use that moment to put animals back on the land.
All right, we will see. Ethanol, its death is has been foretold here by Austin Frerich, the author of Barron's Money, Power.
Knock on wood.
And knock on wood, you say, and the corruption of America's food industry. I'll give you the subtitle again, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. Austin, thanks so much for sharing this with us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Jeffrey.
And that's it for today's JX. From all of us at JPR, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Have a great day.